Letters on Sympathy by Sophia de Grouchy, first published in 1798. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Letter 4. Some Disagreements with Smith.
You have seen, my dear friend, that our sympathy with physical pains and pleasures is proportional to our knowledge from our own experience of their force and effects, and we sympathize in general with moral pains and pleasures according to how much we are susceptible to them. I say in general, because no doubt there are exceptions. Souls sensitive enough to be touched by pains that they would not experience in the circumstances that produce them in others, that is, pains they can appreciate only through imagination and not through experience. And so, as with physical pains that we have not experienced, sympathy with moral pains is stimulated by the general idea of suffering. This opinion is contrary to that of the illustrious Smith. And here I am again, going to take issue with a few of his assertions. You may think this is rash of me, and I do accept that Smith is rightly regarded as one of Europe's top philosophers, but it seems to me that on matters having to do less with profound knowledge than with self-observation, anyone who thinks can claim a right to enter the discussion. I do not believe that Smith indicated the true reason that makes us pity dethroned kings. If we feel for their misfortunes more intensely than for those of other men, it is only because kings seem to us to be protected from such misfortunes by their elevation. So we judge that they must feel misfortunes acutely when they occur. Smith, on the contrary, thinks that the idea of grandeur is tied in most minds to the idea of felicity, and that this predisposes us, by some sort of affection and consideration for their happiness, to sympathize more particularly with kings across the board. It seems to me that this feeling is rare in the British Empire, unknown in the rest of Europe, and absolutely opposed to the sentiment of natural equality that leads us to view everything above us with jealousy or at least with severity. Our sympathy for physical suffering is stronger, more gentle, and more deeply felt than our sympathy for moral sufferings. The spectacle of physical suffering is heartrending and intrusive, even for those who have been distant from the face of pain by their education, or rather by the errors of their education. The reason for this obviously lies in the nature of physical suffering itself. It most often leads to death. It is more striking than moral suffering. Its signs are more certain, and the image of it is more distressing and affects our organs more sympathetically. Smith lays down the contrary proposition, which he thinks he can justify by saying that the imitation of corporeal pains on the stage hardly moves us, and is an object of ridicule rather than of compassion, whereas the imitation of moral sufferings brings more intense impressions to the soul. A man's loss of a leg cannot be made the subject of a tragedy, whereas his loss of his mistress can. Is that because sympathy is weaker for the first loss than for the second? Certainly not. It is purely because it would be hard to create the illusion of physical pain necessary for theatrical success. This imitation would have to be accompanied by moral pains in order to produce a genuine and varied interest, and the appeal of tragedy lies largely in the talent that makes us enjoy our sympathy for the misfortunes of others, by gradually arousing our sensibility, and not by presenting a sudden and heart-rending image of physical suffering, an image that we cannot distance our thoughts from if it latches onto us, and that becomes ridiculous if it does not. Also, it is known that for the populace in general, the public spectacle of physical pain is a real tragedy, a spectacle that it doesn't often look for, except through unthinking curiosity, but the sight of which sometimes awakens its sympathy to the point of turning it into a fearsome passion. Smith says that firmness and courage in physical suffering is a result of how little sympathy such suffering elicits from others. This is absolutely false. Resignation in ordinary hardships and in all-consuming pain is caused by the inevitability of suffering. Indeed, the utility of certain sufferings and the uselessness of complaint. Resoluteness comes either from the desire to be admired or from the kind of contentment that comes with a sense of great courage, a contentment that often keeps courage going and can be a lively pleasure for strong and elevated souls. Smith claims that we sympathize very little with the pleasures of love. If he means by this that we see, without interest, the delights that a deep and pure feeling brings to two young lovers, and the mysterious haven that it draws them into, that we have no interest in the details of a happiness that is so often the object of our own secret plans, then his opinion will be contradicted by the opinion of everyone whose imagination is alive, and whose lives have been given over to this passion. Whenever we see or imagine love that doesn't arouse envy or jealousy, and doesn't offend modesty or our principles of honesty, it pleases us, and awakens impressions of pleasure in us. It can even please us when it stimulates our regrets, because for those who have felt this passion and inspired it, tender and even painful regrets are long-term pleasures. As I have just implied, we can be prevented from fully sympathizing with the joys of love by jealousy, envy, or considerations of honesty and modesty. But we shouldn't infer from this that such sympathy is not natural. It's just that it is less deep in our nature than jealousy and ideas of honesty and modesty. But do notice this. We sympathize more or less with these joys, depending on whether our principles in this regard are more or less severe, more or less complicated, and on how easily we share pleasures that are not natural to us or that we currently lack. It is astonishing that a philosopher whose work shows that he has dispassionately observed both natural man and social man should find something ridiculous in love's passion. One would think that this opinion came from frivolous youthfulness, that judges love before having loved, and thinks it is following the path of true happiness because it aims to obtain pleasure without paying any price. Our sympathy for passions associated with hatred, such as envy, revenge, etc., is not general. It is usually shaped by our personal relations with the person who is having these passions, by our particular sympathy with him that can corrupt our judgment, by how much we know about the rightness of his feelings, and how impressed we are by it, and by how the causes of his feelings relate to our interests, our opinions, and the nature of our sensibility. When sympathy is not energized by any of these particular springs, it gives way to the gentler emotion of pity, and far from sympathizing with hate-filled passions, we are led instead to take an interest in the hated person. The reason for this is a fortunate aspect of our nature. We sympathize with the desire to do good for someone, because a sentiment in us inclines us to do good for all, and to find a personal pleasure in doing so. And we do not sympathize with hatred, because no sentiment in us inclines us to do harm to all. So there must be a particular reason for sympathy towards hatred, as there must be for hatred itself. You will ask me, my dear friend, if that is true, why are there beings who enjoy seeing their fellow creatures tormented, who have a kind of need to spoil the happiness of others, and who never learn of disturbances to the happiness of others without a secret joy? Why, indeed? It is because in society a wicked system of legislation has for too long separated people from one another and set them at odds, instead of getting their interests in harmony. Greed for pleasure has led men to the point where they cannot all satisfy their so-called needs at the same time, needs that are really social fantasies turned into habits. From childhood they easily get into the habit of regarding the lows and highs of others as a given that fortune has provided for their enjoyment. So civilized man if he is governed by prejudices and bad laws, is naturally envious and jealous, and increasingly so as the vices of social institutions distance him further from nature, corrupt his reason, and make his happiness depend on the satisfaction of a greater number of supposed needs. This opinion is so true that the men who can be accused of enjoying the misfortunes of others, and of being saddened by their happiness, seldom feel this way except over troubles involving vanity or luck, or over suffering that comes from a sensibility that they believe to be artificial or exaggerated. And they cease to be like that when the troubles involve physical pain and real misfortune. The exceptions to this observation are very rare, and concern only a very small number of individuals. These are monsters, whose existence can be explained by the particular circumstances of their education and their place in society. Civilization, such as it still exists in half the nations of Europe, is thus the enemy of goodness in man, as well as of his happiness. What an immense labour remains for education! Not to develop nature or direct it, simply to preserve nature's beneficent tendencies, saving them from being stifled by authorized and common prejudices that choke the sentiments of humaneness and equality. Those sentiments are as necessary for the moral happiness of each individual as for maintaining fairness and security in all relations of the social order. Why do we laugh when we see someone being ridiculous? Our tendency to laugh along with people amused by others' flaws and absurdities is no doubt born of sympathy, but that laughter is not what I am asking about. Is it because when we see such things, our pride takes pleasure in the idea of our superiority? This can indeed be one cause of this laughter, but it is not the main one. The usual sign of a feeling of satisfied pride is widely known to be a calm smile. It seems that we would be afraid of cheapening this feeling, in cases where it is appropriate, if we burst out in the peals of laughter that the sight of ridiculous behaviour elicits from us. Also, the idea of our superiority gives us a completely different pleasure from the one produced by the sight of the ridiculous. And anyway, the idea of our superiority makes us look ridiculous more often than it arises from the ridiculousness of others. One can say that the bodily movements that constitute laughter are intrinsically pleasant, though they are sometimes tiring, and that movements bringing tears are painful, though in some circumstances tears bring solace. This helps to explain the sympathy for laughter, sparked by ridiculous behaviour. But it does not explain why ridiculous things lead to the movements that produce laughter, and to the pleasure that precedes it. Children laugh from a very early age. They laugh as soon as they have a clear and wide enough knowledge of objects and states of affairs to compare them. They laugh at the same things we do, since in their games they laugh at those they make their dupes. So the cause of laughter cannot be very complicated and cannot depend on elaborate ideas. Indeed, imbeciles also laugh. They laugh at what surprises them, just as reasonable people laugh at what they find funny. So we should look to children for the cause of laughter, because they have fewer and more limited ideas. We have fewer possible causes to examine, and more hope of finding the right one. This manner of observing the facts from their origin, of which John Locke is the exemplar, is the most certain one for discovering the general laws they fall under. It seems that the most ordinary cause of laughter in children is the sight of an unexpected event that offers them new images and ideas and vigorously exercises their growing faculties. In addition, everything that arouses a feeling of pleasure or anticipation in children also produces laughter, because laughter is the natural expression of everything that affects them agreeably. But the older one gets, the more thinking one does, and the more laughter is reserved for unexpected things that draw our attention without inspiring great interest or being thought about much. The reason for this is simple. The light spasm of laughter, and the accompanying pleasure come to an end when the slightest thought is brought to bear, and unexpected events that we enjoy but do not think about become extremely rare after childhood. That is why in the rest of our lives, laughter, except for imbeciles, is almost exclusively reserved for bizarre, unexpected, or contrasting things, and ridiculous behaviour is among those. The first cause of laughter is thus found in the pleasure we take from an easy and unexpected exercise of our faculties, and from the kind of contentment, of inner joy, that goes with it. So it is obvious that as we grow older, laughter and mockery come together, because the pleasure of feeling our advantages and our power turned into the naughty pleasure of making our superiority felt, a pleasure very like the one that comes from exercising our faculties. You will please forgive me, my dear friend, for working backwards from cause to cause in order to reach the first one, and after having observed that the cause of laughter generally has much to do with the pleasure attached to the exercise of our faculties. You will join me in wanting to search for the origin of that pleasure. To find it, we may need only to notice that the exercise of our faculties improves them, that this improvement is a source of pleasure and avoiding pain, and that children can be aware of this, especially since the improvement of their faculties is very rapid and very important for their welfare. So a sentiment of pleasure is automatically attached to any flexing of our faculties that tends to develop them. This pleasure, which is the same as the pleasure of feeling our own strength, power, capacity, is often concealed from us by habit. So one might think offhand that it must be weak. But in fact it is very intense, and children are the proof of that. The sheer exercise of their faculties, independent of all the pleasures they may find in it, is accompanied in them by every sign of joy. For a long time, this feeling of their own strength is all they need to be happy. The more they cultivate it, the easier it is for them to be happy later in life. What matters most at first is to make this feeling spread across their whole lives for as long as possible. And after that, it is essential not to let them form an exaggerated opinion of their own strength. If when they compare themselves to others, they don't have an extremely fair and accurate opinion of their own strength, their childhood self-esteem, stroked by all the uncritical care they received back then, becomes for them the source of all the mental defects and all the moral vices. But the pleasure tied to the exercise of our faculties has yet other causes. The exercise of our bodily faculties is not only good for our health, but also nearly always produces a feeling of well-being, i.e. the sensation that goes with being in good health, and is a positive pleasure, or at least the recent and agreeable cessation of all painful feelings. This sensation does not just exist for the totality of our organs. Think about it, and you will see that it is felt clearly and separately in each organ. One takes pleasure in walking after a long rest, and in recognizing this pleasure, one thinks one can feel the agreeable sensation that is spread throughout the body, being specially concentrated in the legs. Now, this observation about our bodily faculties can also hold for the organs that come into play when we think and when we have feelings. If overapplying ourselves fatigues us, it may be that going without new ideas for too long is fatiguing in a more unpleasant way. If over-intense emotions, even of joy, produce a painful sensation in the diaphragm, why wouldn't the exclusion and absolute cessation of all feeling not be followed in due course by a painful numbness? It thus appears that movement and action contribute in an essential way to the well-being and even the survival of living beings. As final evidence of this, we have the fact that movement and action are necessary in childhood for the development of the organs, and in old age for their continuing force. Let us return to sympathy. I cannot believe, as Smith does, that we do not sympathize with great joys or small sorrows. It seems to me, on the contrary, that we sympathize with moral pains and pleasures, whatever their force and degree. This is a consequence of what I have been saying about our moral sensibility. Our sensitivity to the great joys of others, as for their minor troubles, is especially keen when it concerns persons for whom we have very strong particular sympathies. In that case, we are obeying nature. On the other side, we are sometimes upset to see someone whom we don't care about making an extraordinary fortune, because this fortune breaks the equality that held between us, or because it stops us from being a level above him, or because what he has is something that we have wanted. If someone socially far below us moves up a class, though still far below our own level, then sympathy will win out over pride, which shows that sympathy exists even when it is not supported by personal interest. This remark is so true that when genuine sympathy is wiped out by personal interest, we can still present our pretended sympathy as a natural and appropriate affection. The sympathy for moral suffering is stronger than for moral pleasure, for the same reason that it is stronger for physical injuries than for physical pleasures. One can, nonetheless, observe that, although moral pains are far more intense than moral pleasures, the difference between them is far less considerable than the difference between physical pains and physical pleasures, and that moral pleasures have a far greater influence on our happiness. Among the effects of sympathy are the power a large crowd has to arouse our emotions, and the power a few men have to inspire us with their opinions. Here are what seem to me a few causes of these phenomena. The mere presence of a large gathering of men acts on us through impressions awakened by their looks, their speech, and the memory of their past actions. Also, their attention draws our attention, and their excitement alerts our sensibility to the emotions it is about to receive, and in so doing triggers those emotions. There is also the pleasure of hearing something said that one would not have risked saying oneself, or perhaps has groped for in vain, or has glimpsed only confusedly. There is also the pleasure of acquiring an idea or sentiment on the spot. When it is very intense, this pleasure sometimes leads us to accept the idea or sentiment without reflection, and we suddenly develop an admiration for the person who awakens it in us. Does not the person who gives you a new idea, my dear friend, seem to have an aura of supernatural power? Sometimes the uncertainty of our ideas and sentiments prevents us from making them fully our own, until we see them shared by others. An idea strikes us as true, beautiful, and touching, but we fear adopting it lightly. Then the applause of others reassures us, decides for us, and we confidently give in to our first inclination. At other times, this same applause alerts us to some thought that escaped our notice, and our own applause, in turn, produces the same effect, and each person enjoys all the pleasures that would otherwise have been parcelled out among many people. A lone individual who, through fear of ridicule or of compromising himself, or through mere timidity, does not dare to wholeheartedly accept a violent sentiment, does dare to do so as soon as this sentiment is shared. Since we sympathize with the passions of others, the signs of those passions move us and suffice to make us feel them. Then, once we are experiencing them with a certain force, the sight of these passions must augment them further. And as we have the same effect on other people, an ever-mounting rush of passion builds up to the highest level each is capable of. Such is the cause of the energy of crimes and of virtues in popular uprisings. Sympathy also comes into the power that certain men exercise over those who hear them speak or read what they write, taking advantage of the character of their souls. This power comes from an art that is not so much difficult as dangerous, but stops being dangerous when it is exposed. These men know that some minds are wearied by doubt, that there are those who, with regard to some topics or with regard to everything, find rest only in the peaceful lap of belief, and that for most men the need to believe wins out over reason, which forbids belief not shown to be right. So they have only to present an opinion forcefully and persuasively, using skill to conceal any uncertainties, and the hearers, pleased to be rescued from doubt, embrace this opinion with an ardour and confidence proportional to how much peace it brings them. Someone can also get believers, inspire confidence in himself and his way of thinking, by choosing certain opinions that are more eagerly received, because they trigger a secret desire to yield to them. This explains the success of writers who declare paradoxes. People secretly take pride in not holding common opinions, and in seeing, even through the eyes of others, something that escapes the common run of men. And this is something that they, the paradox mongers, use to manipulate readers. By a similar mechanism, someone can succeed in rejuvenating old opinions. He has on his side all the people who were forced to abandon these opinions, reluctantly, and have been afraid to maintain them. They take pleasure in spoiling the triumph of those who seek to destroy prejudices and establish new truths. A project that the amour propre of men of middling ability describes as foolhardy, tries to cast doubt on, and will never forgive, because it claims a superiority that is demeaning to such men. Another, and perhaps the most efficacious, way of winning minds is to attach to generally recognized principles, especially ones that are accepted with enthusiasm, other opinions that are in no way their consequence. When that is done, the latter opinions come with an escort that gets them respected. If a writer agrees with us on important matters and professes opinions dear to us, we are inclined to believe him on other things as well. Indeed, sometimes someone can persuade others merely by using certain sacred words that inspire a kind of veneration and enthusiasm because of the grand ideas they evoke. The art of placing such words in a manner that makes them substitute for reasons and thoughts, and affects the souls of readers and listeners in a way that deprives them of their critical power, is one of the most reliable secrets of false eloquence. And in our day it has made the passing reputation of more than one political orator. The successes of genuine talent are even easier to explain, because they are almost entirely the work of nature. If a writer or orator expresses himself passionately, we are bound to feel the emotion aroused by the sight of someone agitated by an intense and profound sentiment. And this emotion, which automatically echoes his, inclines us to share the sentiment, provided that its cause strikes us as sufficient. The influence these men have over us is not limited to making us warmly embrace views we would otherwise have regarded coldly. It also affects what we believe. If you carefully examine what leads us to believe something, you'll see that one of the strongest and most common sources of belief is our natural and involuntary tendency to regard something as constant, if we have seen it repeated many times, a tendency that is a consequence of our constitution. We regard as having always existed anything that we have ourselves experienced as a constancy. In our unreflective moments, we don't distinguish an opinion that always accompanies the idea of something that is habitually repeated from an opinion arising from the impression of something that strikes us vividly, that is, arises from sense experience. This makes us more apt to believe anything that moves us, and to adopt the opinions of passionate authors. Such is the art of Rousseau, their model. He fills you with his own conviction, immediately creating in the depths of your heart an emotion in favour of the opinion he wants to impart, as strongly in favour as if the entire case for it consisted of things that you had long accepted. One of Rousseau's contemporaries, Voltaire, may have had an even more striking and general influence on this century, at least if one does not limit oneself to France. But their approaches, equally crowned by success, were not the same. Rousseau spoke more to conscience, Voltaire to reason. Rousseau established his views on the strength of his sensibility and his logic. Voltaire by the stimulating charms of his wit. The one instructed men by touching them, the other by enlightening them, while also entertaining them. The former, taking some of his principles too far, has spread a taste for exaggeration and oddness. The latter, too often content to fight the most dreadful abuses with no weapon but ridicule, has not widely enough aroused against them the salutary indignation which, while less effective than scorn in scolding vice, is more vigorous in fighting it. Rousseau's morality is appealing, though severe. It carries the heart along even while reproaching it. Voltaire's is more indulgent, and perhaps has less effect on us, because demanding fewer sacrifices. It gives us a more limited idea of our strengths, and of the perfection we can attain. Rousseau spoke of virtue with as much charm as Fénelon, and with the power of virtue itself on his side. Voltaire fought against religious prejudices as zealously as if they were the only enemy of our happiness. The former will renew, through the ages, enthusiasm for freedom and virtue. The latter will awaken every century to the dire effects of fanaticism and credulity. Still, given that there will be passions as long as there are men, Rousseau's influence over souls will still be at the service of our manners and morals, long after Voltaire's influence over minds has completed its destruction of the prejudices opposing the happiness of societies. End of letter 4.